Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder and you can find this and everything that we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do the feminization of American culture. We're going to finish up chapter 4. The subtitle we're going to do is called Anti-Institutionalism, the Pastor and the Sentimental Heroine. Anti-Institutionalism, the Pastor and the Sentimental Heroine. Page 181, and this will carry up through like 196, I think it is. Yeah, 196, and that will end chapter 4. Let's see. This is, again, The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, written back in, published back in 1977. A fascinating and original vision of the origins of modern mass culture. Indispensable reading for modern feminists, and indeed anybody else of serious intelligence, says the New York Times. Kind of about the intellectual degradation of the American Protestant clergy, the effeminization of the clergy, and the rise of feeling and sentiment, their triumph over solid thinking. So, the anti-intellectualism, as we pick up on 181, which had begun to pervade the non-evangelical minister's theology by the mid-century, inevitably affected his concept of the institution to which he belonged and the role he was to play in it. J.H. Allen astutely remarked that the voluntary system had produced, quote, spiritualism and sentimentalism, but that it had failed and, quote, and must always fail in building up an institution. The liberal clergyman promoted, if ambiguously, a personalized and deprofessionalized church. He lost confidence in the special and established claims of his own denomination. He habitually joined forces, ecumenicalism, that is, or tried to, with Christians of all beliefs, in worship and recreational activities. He evaded ecclesiastical self-definition, so, oh, let's do what we have in common, let's ignore the differences, let's not take our own beliefs really seriously, because in the end, what is, as the Skinner said, or Reverend Lovejoy says in that one Simpsons, in the end, maybe you'd be happy with their denomination, they're all really pretty much the same. That's an example of theological liberalism, if you remember that old Simpsons bit. But that's kind of what was happening. These were more serious when they were more serious. They took distinctions more seriously. After all, smoothing things over is feminine. Making sharp delineations is masculine. So thought is inevitably associated with masculinity. And feelings inevitably associated with femininity. The most extraordinary and inspiring expounder of anti-institutionalism within the liberal ranks was Joseph Tuckerman, as it sounds, 1778 to 1841. Born of a Boston patrician and mercantile family, from an early age Tuckerman was known for his blameless conduct, his intensely emotional nature, and his devotion to literature. In many ways, Tuckerman dominated, as he himself said, by his affections rather than his thoughts, was prototypical of the new liberal minister. Channing explained, his strength did not lie in abstract speculation. His heart was his great power. Tuckerman joined with his sensibility a concern for the urban poor, shared by few of his equally sensitive clerical contemporaries. Forced by ill health to abandon a regular Unitarian pastorate in 1826, he founded the much more strenuous, quote, ministry at large, a small interdenominational and ad hoc band of free, quote unquote, ministers, tackling economic, social, and spiritual ills wherever they found them in whatever way seemed the most appropriate. Deeply troubled by the fact that almost half of the 13,320 Protestant families in Boston had no religious affiliation at all, Tuckerman lamented the exclusiveness which characterized the majority of urban Protestant churches. Pews could only be occupied by those who bought or rented them. It's kind of like a synagogue. The impoverished were consigned ignominiously to special seats. Churches were organized, in other words, to congratulate the rich, rather than to save the poor. Tuckerman became increasingly suspicious of all organized religious effort. He hated official charity as fiercely as any proud pauper. A crusader against centrally controlled state philanthropy, he wanted the local communities voluntarily to care for their own deprived. And this is the traditional distinction made between socialism, that people on the local level know the deserving poor from the undeserving poor, and that it also is not real charity if it's forced by law. So the effect on the giver and the recipient is completely different if it's an entitlement versus something freely given and freely accepted. The only part he would have allowed the state to play was in penalizing towns that failed to erect workhouses and other necessary facilities. The essence of Tuckerman's philanthropic style was personal service and care. He claimed to be, quote, of no party, unquote, and he spoke to and for those who had no interest in being members of a church, for those who had no interest in hearing a minister, but who felt a genuine need for what Tuckerman called a Christian friend. He wanted to enter the houses of the poor rather than to draw them into church. True religion for him was impossible without the, quote, sympathy, interest, respect, love, unquote, which the poor so seldom received. The only church which mattered existed any place where these qualities were in operation. So he would say, like, it's more like the Jesus was than the institution, the spirit, not its instantiation in a institution. So he would say, where's the church? It's not a building. It's wherever you find sympathy, interest, respect, and love, and genuine dedication to helping the poor, like Jesus. Tuckerman underplayed his clerical role. He believed fervently in the sanctity of the ministry, but he saw its virtue precisely in its self-disavowal, in its intrinsically unprofessional nature. It is character only which gives any power to office, he asserted. That is, you can give a man a title, but unless he has the character, you can't compel respect. In Tuckerman's eyes, the minister possessed but one valid creed, that contained in his personal example. So he would say, like, you've got to believe your own bullshit, and you've got to behave your own bullshit. You have to act the way that you say you should. And if you don't, even the dimmest will recognize that you probably don't believe what you're actually saying. And then you become like most people. You're advocating one thing and doing something else. It is difficult even today to read Tuckerman's Ministry at Large with its stress on local control, its relatively enlightened analysis of the cause of poverty, and its eloquent language, and not feel the author's impassioned, intelligent, and crystalline concern and love for the people of whom he writes. Tuckerman was some sort of saint, if a minor one. He was not alone, however, in his disinterest in ecclesiastical institutions. Henry Ward Beecher, who chattered more naturally with the sinners than with the saints, showed the same anti-institutionalism and anti-professionalism later in the century, but he substituted a manufactured intimacy for principled care. Tuckerman disavowed institutions to protect the social community, broadly conceived. Beecher was an exemplar of the force of sheer personality, and personality dedicated to the needs of an audience, not to the purposes of a community. Lyman Beecher, every inch a churchman, quote-unquote, fought atheists, Unitarians, Episcopalians, and Roman Catholics to the death. He did everything, short of abandoning his own heresies, to preserve the precarious unity of the congregational Presbyterian evangelical front. His most famous son appealed to the Congregationalists and freethinkers alike. Finding what close friends he had among businessmen, journalists, and lawyers, rather than among clergymen, Henry Ward Beecher advised candidates for the sacred office to, quote, avoid a professional manner, unquote, and reminded them constantly that they were, quote, men before they were ministers. In the sometimes embarrassingly overt sexual language he habitually used to describe the successful minister's performance, he was to, quote, thrust and, quote, lunge and, quote, pour his manhood, unquote, out over his congregation, Beecher makes the clergyman sound more like an exhibitionist than an ecclesiastical dignitary. He preached without a pulpit, standing almost within touch of his audience. He advocated that ministers not write out their sermons, but speak extempore, speaking extemporaneously. He was after impression as much as truth. And I got to say, I agree with a lot of that. You know, the writer can be a rapist. The writer or the speaker, it's not pleasant to listen to anyone give a canned speech. It basically tells the audience that you don't know what you're speaking on well enough. And that doesn't mean rehearse it until you have it memorized. It means you should be able to speak about it and think about it at the same time if you truly understand what you're saying. And you should be able, and Hitler talks about this, to look into your audience, have them look into your eyes. That's why it's important. He's standing right next to them. They can see in his eyes whether he's serious or not. They can see whether he cares about them. They can see whether he knows what he's talking about. They can judge all these things better when he's doing it, and he can judge them as well. He can see what they need and how best to give it to them if he's looking at them and watching them respond even as he's speaking. And all this comes with practice, but too many people prefer to give a set speech where they write it out and essentially deliver a written paper, but that's, to my way of thinking, quite boring. Get over yourself, get through yourself, and tell me what I need to know that you know, is one's attitude toward the speaker. Or otherwise, don't waste my time. Now, he advocated that ministers not write out their sermons, but speak extempore. He was after impression as much as truth. Lyman Beecher, anxious to get his first revival underway in East Hampton, had taken, quote, hold without mittens. Henry Ward characteristically wished, that would be like oven mittens, I think. Henry Ward characteristically wished metaphorically to extend from the pulpit a, quote, warm and glowing palm, bared to the touch. He was intent on seduction, not compulsion or rape. He seldom talked of the church. He almost never spoke of doctrine except to debunk it. To be a minister, to belong to a church, was only to court definition and claustrophobia. Preachers are, quote, all partialists, unquote, he warned. Quote, a man's study should be everywhere. The world is my den. The only authority Beecher craved was that of omnivorousness. He wished to be as pervasive and as intimate as appetite. Tuckerman and Beecher represented the two extremes of the new anti-institutionalism developing the liberal clergy between 1820 and 1875, and many of their colleagues ranged between them. An admiring acquaintance said of Ezra Stiles Gannett, or Gannett, if it's the USA Today pronunciation, one of the most conscientious, hard-working, earnest, and fervently Unitarian ministers of the early and mid-19th century, that he was among the last clergymen to have a sense of, quote, ministerial brotherhood. Gannett was associated with Channing at the Federal Street Church in Boston, and he was often troubled by Channing's publicly stated dissatisfaction at being confined within one creed, even the notoriously loose Unitarian one. Quote, I belong to the Universal Church, unquote, Channing proclaimed in 1841. Nothing shall separate me from it. The founder of American Unitarianism felt the spirit of sectarianism was from hell, in quotes. Charles Follen, a prophet of the ecumenical trend of the later transcendental Unitarian clergy, claimed with Channing to be a member of the, quote, Universal Church, unquote, sympathizing even with Jews and Catholics. Edwin H. Chapin, one of the most popular preachers in New York City, was thought to be a universalist only because it was impossible to tell what he was. Such ministers stressed the devotional and practical, rather than the doctrinal or ecclesiastical aspects of faith. They were not without feminine models and adherents. Women like Lydia Maria Child or Catherine Maria Sedgwick repudiated sectarianism and partialism as fervently as Channing himself. Even as they proliferated their own associations, organizations, societies, and clubs, middle-class American women revealed a deep-seated and extreme distrust, integral to their envy of the professions and institutions which excluded them. Catherine Esther Beecher's crusade against Yale was only part of a larger campaign in which she had many sisterly assistants. Of these, Dorothea Dix was perhaps the most talented and significant. I believe she's associated with mental hospitals. Dix was born in 1802 to an ill-sorted couple. Her father was an alcoholic and a fanatic convert from Congregationalism to Methodism. Her mother, an uneducated woman, some 18 years older than her husband. Dix spent a miserable childhood mainly with her grandmother, whom she likened to Medusa, the Greek mythic figure with snakes for hair. She said in later years that she, quote, never knew childhood, and her short career as a brilliant but excessively demanding and inflexible teacher proved her right. Until her late 20s, she was devoured by literary ambition of a conventional variety. She could write a confidant on one occasion about paying her, quote, watery tribute to the genius of L.E.L., a popular poetess. Like they would say, Oscar Wilde is Swinburne plus water. That's what they mean by watery there, diluted or not as potent or powerful. Dix turned out the usual volumes of Sunday school fiction and sentimental poetry, bearing predictable titles like The Garland of Flora. A convert to Unitarianism, she took care of Channing's children in the early 1830s and received all the benefits of his affection, discipline, and respect. With her consumptive tendency and her literary sensibility, she seemed in early womanhood, as a friend said, quote, an invalid, a very gentle and poetical and sentimental young lady. In the mid-1830s, she went abroad for her health and returned in 1838. 36 years old, unmarried, unknown, and unhappy, aimless, rather typical minor lady literateur. Then, by a near accident, she saw the inside operations of a neighboring jail. The rage and conviction this visit inspired in her led to a highly motivated career of prison, hospital, and asylum reform, which lasted almost until the century's close. And that's what she's famously associated with, mental hospitals. Dix was very much a minister at large, reading her Bible aloud to quell the madmen. Dix was taking on, at the least, a clerical role. One of her biographers has noted perceptively that her Massachusetts memorial has certain similarities to Edwards's famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Lydia Maria Child christened her a, quote, God-appointed missionary to the insane. Dix rebuked strangers and presidents with absolute self-confidence and proclaimed herself, quote, the hope of the poor. The hope of the poor crazed beings who pine in cells and stalls and cages. And again, the WASP are the people of go to your room and think about what you've done. This is the mentality that produces the penitentiary, where you're supposedly penitent rather than merely caged. So sort of an exquisite form of psychological torture masquerading as character reform. The revelation of hundreds of wailing, suffering creatures. That's how she described herself. The hope of the poor, crazed beings who pine in cells and stalls and cages. The revelation of hundreds of wailing, suffering creatures. Like Tuckerman, moreover, Dix always worked on an essentially individualized, maverick, ad hoc, although tightly controlled, plan. Whether consciously or not, she exploited the doctrine of female influence to the hilt. Beautiful, well-educated, socially conservative, politically tactful, welcome in both the North and the South before and after the war, she besieged state legislatures and important personages with impassioned appeals still well within the limits of decorum. One admirer remarked that he had seen in chapels of asylums Dix had founded or visited portraits of her placed and adored as one might expect an icon of the Virgin to be. Dix grasped the potential force of the veneration, accorded the lady in the place of power. So, okay, our power, we don't have the formal power men do, but they can still worship us the way they worship Mother Mary. And let me use that power to achieve this institutional reform in how we deal with the insane. I will go and talk to the important people north and south, and I will act passionately but within the bounds of decorum and see if I can bring them around. And I know I can, because I know my cause is just, and I know that I'm a perfect avatar of it. So this was how Dorothea Dix was thinking. There are stamps with her on it. Dix grasped the potential force of the veneration accorded to the lady in place of power. She could be unique, autonomous, the arbiter and not the subject of moral judgment, the holy opponent rather than the intimate, rather than the inmate of all merely man-made institutions. It was symbolic that on Dix's crusading trips abroad in later life, she was actually to boast of her inability to speak a foreign tongue and of her ability to accomplish exactly what she wanted anyway. Dix's charge against the prisons, hospitals, and insane asylums of her day had many motives, the most important of which was the criminally inadequate conditions which prevailed in them. Like Tuckerman, Dix, for all her occasional and self-sustaining posturing, had a sense of a wider community which never left her. It was her distinction that she pledged herself never to forget those society was determined to ignore. That's a standard leftist line. In a very what is actually is a veiled call for expansion of government power when it comes from the leftist. But it's easier to believe when someone actually spends their whole life supporting those poor. In a very real sense, Dix's chosen foe, like Tuckerman's, was organization per se in and of itself. Once asked at an asylum to inspect the superintendent's suite, she replied, "Oh no, doctor, I've never found any suffering among officers of an institution." During the Civil War, an older and more paranoid Dix, appointed superintendent of nurses and determined to help soldiers since she could not be one, revealed new extremes of distrust for professionalism and professionals. So you gotta like that. She doesn't like experts. Professionals or degrees or institutions. They're like, let's just freaking do it. I like that spirit. She required no nursing experience for her volunteers, though she did demand that they be 30 or over and homely. And she calmly instructed them to obey her rather than the doctors for whom they were actually working. A one-woman vigilante squad, she refused to take off a single day during the whole course of the war. She attempted to cut off the doctor's liquor supply and to oversee and correct every branch of wartime medical practice. And as an observer remarked, she could not work within any system, for she belonged to the class of comets. Funny. Dix irritated military authorities by being, in the words of one exasperated official, in a perpetual state of breathless excitement. George Templeton Strong, a sanitary commissioner, seized on the absurd and hysterical aspects of her over-concern. Black quote. She is disgusted with us because we do not leave everything else and rush off the instant she tells us of something that needs attention. The last time we were in Washington, she came upon us in breathless excitement to say that a cow in the Smithsonian grounds was dying of sunstroke, and she took it very ill that we did not adjourn instantly to look after the case. That'll give you a sense of her character for sure. Strong was annoyed at that inability to establish proportions that understandably crippled many of Dix's sex. What he failed to note was that her anxiety arose from her horror, here focused on a petty but symbolic detail, that all these professionally trained, wage-earning men might quite simply be incompetent. After Dix had opened the door of her first state-run jail and seen the enormities, the horrible atrocities, of neglect and maltreatment there, that's a rare correct use of the term, she doubted. In a sense, she enjoyed the doubts because they implied that if men were apparently not helped or even disabled by their training for the task of running the world, the burden fell on her. And her apparent and feminine lack of qualifications then became a positive asset for the task. If the men with degrees can't do it, then maybe us passionate women can do it. Yet the intense, distorted, but oppressive sense of unending obligation which resulted from her frightening conclusion that she was the only wakeful passenger on a ship headed for a certain wreck was real, too. So she definitely felt herself to be a sort of a savior, and that's what motivated and drove her for good and for ill. It may at first glance seem strange or unexpected that Dick should have turned from youthful aspirations to be a literary lady to adult ambition to be the unassisted savior of her nation. But her progression was in reality a natural one. Tuckerman, too, as a young man, fervently loved literature. He, too, found his mature identity in a less hyperbolic, but no less maverick missionary endeavor. Dix had liked to read sentimental fiction, and a number of her admirers described her in terms which suggest heroines of such stories. From Washington, Horace Mann wrote his wife, the former Mary Peabody, that he was happy to be Dix's lackey and to fight in her cause. He, quote, loved to picture her, he continued enthusiastically, quote, entering alone realms of darkness where man did not dare set his foot, or with a hymn upon her lips quieting the fiercest raging of madness, unquote. Like Florence Nightingale, the English, quote, lady of the lamp, unquote, who would so resemble her in temperament and achievement, that's one of the main nurses in the 18th century, Dix translated readily into automatically charged conventional pictures and ideas. Dix enabled or inspired man, Horace Mann, to draw on the stereotypes of ideal feminine virtue prevalent in his society. He found it natural to fictionalize her, and it is easy to see why. The heroine of sentimental literature is typically, as we have seen, an amateur minister handily outdoing her established clerical competitors. Whether she is outside the church or spiritually at its helm, she cannot be a mere parishioner, a mere party member, a mere cog. The reader seldom learns her exact religious affiliation. Like Dix and Tuckerman, she works alone, as a one-woman unit. I cannot think of a single heroine in the hundreds of sentimental novels I have read whose basic identity is tied up with a philanthropic group. These heroines, says Douglas, these heroines are all, of course, incessantly engaged in charitable missions, dispensing cold jellies, warm stockings, and prayers, but they are always alone. In such stories, women who belong to do-good associations are usually villains. It is as if to join a benevolent society is to abandon one's femininity. Rose Clark, the suffering heroine of a novel by Fanny Fern, meets harsh treatment at the hands of Mrs. Markham, a cold, grasping matron who runs the orphanage where she lives. Mrs. Markham cuts off Rose's hair, locks her in dark closets, and even whips her. In most sentimental novels, however, institutions of any kind are not so much attacked as ignored. Not infrequently, the heroine will engage in activities which the historian reader knows were the object of powerful reform-minded organizations, but she will never, apparently, think of joining or mentioning them. Eva Van Arsdale, in Stowe's, Harriet Beecher Stowe's, New York novels, for example, rescues prostitutes, redeems drunkards, returns lost animals, and provides an ex officio neighborhood community center, but never involves herself in a purity campaign, a temperance drive, an anti-vivisection league, or a settlement house. We seldom learn of a fictional heroine's activities, even in school or in a store. Like Tuckerman's, her chosen philanthropic arena is the home, whether someone else's or her own. Furthermore, she never attacks poverty or intemperance or prostitution as a social phenomenon. That one in itself presupposes a degree of abstraction which she would find abhorrent and irrelevant. Her attempt, like Tuckerman's, is always to, quote, improve conditions to the greatest possible extent by improving character. And she offers the side of her own example to inspire her beneficiaries. The differences between the sentimental heroine or those who created and imitated her and figures like Tuckerman and Dix are obvious and important. Tuckerman and Dix had an intellectually defined and morally vivid purpose to which literature was subservient. Tuckerman, throughout his book on his ministry at large, addresses his reader personally and speaks to him always as, quote, an individual. He refuses to allow his audience to escape into its collective irresponsibility. Every truth, he feels, is by nature ad hominem, that is, personal. He wants to convey the privacy of intense conviction. The domestic novelist also personalized her readership, but she was as interested in manufacturing a privatized experience for her readers as in awakening their consciences. She was so concerned with the isolation created by fantasy rather than the solitude imposed by a moral commitment. Tuckerman was using literature as Dix used her tracts and petitions to reestablish essentially communal values. The domestic novelist was plying her trade to convey an illusion of community through the shared consumer pleasures available in the mass society. Tuckerman grew up decades before the vogue of the sentimental heroine was full-blown. Dix's girlhood barely coincided with the heroine's rise. At most, one could say that Tuckerman anticipated certain of her qualities, and that Dix borrowed her invulnerability in order to engage in crucial societal tasks. Yet the conjunction and progressive degradation of minister, lady reformer, and sentimental heroine is unmistakable, and the process of assimilation imperiled the passionate precision which alone can edge and validate antipathy to institutional and professional life. Passionate precision alone can validate antipathy to institutional and professional life. That's worth remembering, that phrase. And I hope and believe that's what we're doing with this learning college. We have to be passionate and precise in order to bring you this stuff that's outside of the duly accredited institutional structure. So you see, you and me will most likely very much identify with what's going on here. That doesn't mean we need to be less precise, is the word that Douglas uses. If anything, we need to be as precise as we can be in order to make up for the institutional strengths that we don't have as a fully functioning brick-and-mortar institution. And we do that by picking better stuff, covering it thoroughly, and arranging it into logical order. Now, we could elaborate on this process of deterioration by looking at another aspect of the minister's professional self-image. In Truth Stranger Than Fiction, Catherine Beecher has espoused her, quote, parochial clergy. The ministers are pastors as part of her attack on the clerical scholars and theologians, and with good reason. The pastor, as he was increasingly defined, was in several senses a sister. Tuckerman had never been a particularly forceful or scholarly minister, and he tended always to see himself as a pastor rather than a preacher or a theologian. The distinction, the theologian would be like a scholar, the preacher would be like a teacher or lecturer, the pastor would be like a care manager or case manager almost. The distinction became an even more frequent and crucial one in liberal ranks. In an interesting series of sermons on the duties of the ministry, Edwards A. Park pointed to a bifurcation between the theologian who is to, quote, cherish learning as a mark of status, and, quote, discriminate between the authority of the mass of believers and the authority of a few learning minds, and the pastor who is, if anything, to conceal what scholarship he has and to attend and to speak to the domestic griefs and private joys of his congregation. So the pastor caters to the congregation, and the theologian is a scholar, and the preacher is more in between, I guess. Interestingly enough, Park saw the theologian as a masculine figure. One of his key words for Moses Stuart, for example, was manly, while he viewed the pastor as feminine. Quote, so gentle and well-nigh domestic is the pastor's vocation, Park explains, as in the view of some, to steal away his manly energy. So you always have to be listening and soothing and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of inherently, men can do it, but it's inherently feminine more than masculine. Stuart, as Park well knew, belonged to an older generation of ministers. Nathaniel Emmons, like Samuel Hopkins, in his effort to keep himself free from temporal cares, courted ignorance not only of his own personal affairs, but of his parishioners as well. He made no pastoral calls except in cases of emergency. Channing's colleague Ezra Stiles Gannett, who idolized his fervently devout mother and found his father, a liberal minister, inaccessible, who always needed to lean on an, quote, arm of love, as his son wrote, was convinced his pastoral work was his most important duty. He called on his numerous parishioners in their own homes at least once a year, and sometimes more. In his view, the pastor's task, like the woman's, lay in the home, and like hers, it was composed of telling minutiae of particulars. So the ability to generalize and spot patterns is more associated with men, where the ability to worry about small points is more women, even if you're worrying, the small points are trying to soothe them over. See, why does this person feel bad? Why does this person feel the way he does? How can we reconcile them? Henry Ware Jr. was the Unitarian beau ideal or beau ideal of a pastor in the first half of the 19th century. Like Gannett, he idolized his mother and found relations with his kind, but very reserved and strict father, difficult. Ware later analyzed the repressive effect Ware Sr., a prominent preacher and scholar at Harvard Divinity School, had on his emotional development. Quote, "My father's dislike of ostentation, showiness, in religion has, I fear, been injurious. It has made me silent on the subject, backward to introduce it, has made it difficult for me to speak of it with warmth, much as I love it." Ware Jr. did not, however, like, quote, "very ardent and fervent devotional exercises," which he felt made as tyrannical demands on the individual's emotional capacities as his father's intellectualized and restrained style of worship did on his mental resources. He wanted affection, not passion. He was very much a religion of gentleness, never effusive, never intimate with anyone outside the circle of his family and a few chosen friends. He personalized the abstractions of his creed into a new clerical lifestyle. Unlike his father, who was a skilled controversialist, able to quell the doughtiest anti-Unitarian opponents, Ware Jr. was hardly a brilliant student. Of a literary bent, he always lacked the thorough discipline of an accomplished theologian. His object was never to display great audition, nor even striking talents in the pulpit. Ware thought both of these, finally, hindrances to the minister's true task, his, quote, "private duties," unquote, the pastoral visits and ministrations in which he exerts the most real religious influence, quote unquote, on the, quote, "characters of men," by promoting personal religion, all those in quotes. So are you supposed to be a scholar, or are you supposed to be like a doctor of the soul? There are two different ideas of the proper role of the clergy. The ministerial role, as Ware conceived it, in contrast to Hopkins or Emmons' view, was rather that of a nurse than a doctor, a mother rather than a father. Henry Ware's biographer and brother, John, describes a fascinating scene in which Henry's wife urges him to take on some single great work and cease dissipating his talents in scattered poems, sketches, sermons, and pastoral calls. Ware gently rebukes his wife for such masculine sentiments, answering with the standard feminine rationale for the inconspicuous achievement, "I am glad to do the little good that I can in any way that presents itself." He quoted, "In 1829, the first professorship of pulpit eloquence and pastoral care was created at Harvard Divinity School. Significantly, it was specially earmarked for Henry Ware, Jr. In 1816, Ware had ministered to the smallest Unitarian society in Boston, and although he had done extremely well there, it was with the assumption of the Harvard post that he came fully into his own. He had been chosen precisely for his purity of character, his emphasis on pastoral work and personal religion, and he was expected in his new role to be, as he well knew, a great influence not only for good for his students, but on other ministers. So they made him he was given the first professorship of pulpit eloquence and pastoral care at Harvard Divinity School. So he had been set on a hill, very much so that his light might shine before the world. His example was to permeate the clerical ranks. His appointment signalized Harvard's skillful attempt to assimilate and ratify the anti-institutionalism increasingly characterizing the liberal faith, or the liberal faith Harvard represented. By all accounts, Ware was successful in just the terms he was meant to be. He invited his students to tea, got to know many of them well, encouraged them to engage in philanthropic activities. As one student later wrote, he raised the standard of ministerial character. In 1831, he published On the Formation of the Christian Character, his most significant work, and a fitting manifesto and rationale for his new position. Ware wrote his wife in 1831 that he was surprised to learn, quote, how strongly people feel, unquote, about the book. Quote, they speak to me of it with tears in their eyes. In his tract, Ware takes the usual Unitarian line, but more radically. He steers entirely clear of dogma. He heads straight for sensibility, if at a suitably gracious speed. The institutional aspects of religious life are underplayed. In discussing the means of religious improvement, Ware gives only a third of the allotted space to the activities of attendance at preaching and partaking in communion. The book is a how-to manual addressed very much to the private individual. Intimacy of tone is heightened by the fact that, as Ware makes clear from the start, he speaks only to those who already agree with him. He writes, quote, only for those who are desirous of knowing themselves and are bent upon forming a religious character. Conversion and controversy are irrelevant here. The issue is the necessity and pleasure of further assimilation among those who already resemble one another. In a loaded metaphor, one could say that Ware's book signalizes the transition from family ties to incest. Intellectual discrimination is by definition impossible. Ware explains that religion is a matter of personal application and experience, a sentiment or affection of the heart, an affair of mediating or meditating in, quote, habitual thoughtfulness of mind, and performing, quote, simple and blameless tasks. Faith is entirely consonant with human nature. The devout Christian walks, quote, in communion with another sphere, unquote. All is harmony, unity, tranquility for him. Quote, his duty and his inclination are one. To him, heaven has already begun, unquote. Like Henry Ward Beecher, Ware, to use Bushnell's phrase, is basking rather than abiding. The pastor has become the advocate of self-love. Ware advises keeping a diary. Well, it says dairy, but I assume they mean diary. Because cows are the greatest spiritual Cersonis we will ever find in this world. This vale of tears and milk. Ware advises keeping a diary, and undertaking daily self-scrutiny and examination for the best formation of Christian character. Of course, such self-investigation was an integral part, think about what you've done, of the Puritan tradition, but the emphasis is different here. This is a leisurely counting over of one's emotional resources rather than a strict balancing of one's quotidian, daily, account with one's maker. Where did I err today? Where did I sin today? What must I do tomorrow? Ware is also especially concerned with Christian conversion, or conversation, a topic which he claims preoccupied the Savior and his disciples. Again, Ware's interest is divided between the value of self-control and the lure of self-display. Let your example, quote, of cheerful, innocent, blameless words exhibit the uprightness and purity of a mind controlled by habitual principle and be a recommendation of the religion you profess, he tells his readers. Under the guise of a justified self-approval, Ware subtly offers the pleasures of the mirror, self-communion. Be a good example to the Lord and brush your hair. Look at yourself. How beautiful you are. Be an example to others, a light unto them. Ware urges his followers not to ignore, quote, the abundance of books, among which, quote, God has graciously ordered that your lot shall be cast, unquote. He suggests at least an hour of reading a day, and although the Bible is, of course, to his mind, the primary text for study, he recommends getting a list of other books from a minister. He states his belief that, quote, no work of truth and science, or of elegance and taste, which does not tend to corrupt the morals or create a disrelish for serious thought, need be prohibited to a religious man. Ware's ideal Christian, metaphorically and literally speaking, reads rather than acts. The assiduous friend of various notable women writers such as Maria Edgeworth and Joanna Baillie, B-A-I-L-L-I-E, Ware was himself a minor poet and litterateur. He wrote about the beauties of nature, village funerals, and other matters of the heart as aids and corollaries to the, quote, formation of Christian character. Interestingly enough, he had provided in his popular tract, which forms the apotheosis of his pastoral mission, an exact theological rationale and description for the behavior of the heroine of sentimental literature. Jane Elton, the heroine of Catherine Maria Sedgwick's first novel, A New England Tale, 1822, written to defend and advertise the Unitarian creed, is an anticipation of Ware's thinking. An orphan, living with an uncongenial Calvinist aunt, she is modest, quiet, intelligent, affectionate, pious, grave, and reflective. She breaks one engagement because her fiancé, Edward Erskine, is not a believer. Her text might well be, quote, be ye not yoked with unbelievers. But she seems less motivated by adherence to doctrinal purity than by the realization, quote, that my most sacred pleasures and hopes must be solitary, unquote, if she marries him. She firmly believes in the central tenet of the liberal creed, that God has, quote, in his wisdom implanted the principle of self-love in our bosoms, unquote, and she finally weds a like-minded Quaker. The pleasures of self-contemplation, as well as of congeniality, are ensured by their similarity. Sedgwick was a close friend of Ware's. He read, admired, and even directed her writing, and their shared preoccupation may be in part attributable to their common faith and their personal intimacy. Yet later fictional heroines, whose creators never knew Ware or shared his creed, conform as closely as Jane Elton to the dictates of On the Formation of the Christian Character, italics. Fleda, the successor to Ellen Montgomery and the star of Susan Warner's second bestseller, Queechy, Q-U-E-E-C-H-Y, 1852, inhabits a world very much like the narcissistic one envisaged in Ware's tract. It exists not in or for itself, but only to discipline and create moral character. It is there only so that the sentimental heroine may become a Christian and make others so. Fleda finds her little world, quote, a veil of soul-making, if in a rather limited way. An orphan, she is living at the start of the story with her very elderly and venerable grandfather, Mr. Ringan, notable for his, quote, womanly sweetness and impracticality. He dies, and she, like Ellen Montgomery, sets off in her travels. Fleda is serious, well-read, constantly looking on the spiritual and moral side of life, thoughtful, devotional. She has a young guardian, some 20 years older than herself, called Mr. Carleton, who anticipates Elsie Dinsmore's famous sire. At the story's start, Carleton is well-to-do, handsome, brilliant, charming, but proud, defiant, even Byronic. He has not found religious certainty or Fleda. Fleda affects Carleton's regeneration with relative ease. Warner, like Ware, is less interested in conversion than in congratulation. The pair then proceed along a heavy and uninterrupted course of common improvement. Their conversations, conforming precisely to Ware's injunctions, inch forward in a step-by-step process of observation, testing, and displaying, reminiscent of the absolute earnestness of the conversation that women like Catherine Sedgwick and Eliza Fallon reported in the 1820s in the Boston Unitarian Circle, of which Ware was a part. Their discourse is a liberalized catechism or education in which both teacher and pupil are instructed, fostered, and buoyed, lifted up. One could say they take turns playing pastor to each other. Here is a typical example of Fleda and Carlton moving inexorably from the trivial to the profound, their supposedly acute critical faculties only sharpening the rigidly unscrutinized pleasure of total mutual and self-esteem. Ah, the good old wasp high-mindedness. Beautiful minds. Us and our beautiful minds. Strolling the garden path through life. They are walking arm in arm along a city street. This is an extended block quote from this book or novel. How pretty the curl of blue smoke is from that chimney, he said. It was said with a tone so carelessly easy that Fleda's heart jumped. I know it, she said eagerly. I have often thought of it, especially here in the city. Why is it? What is it? Fleda's eye gave one of its exploratory looks at his before she spoke. Isn't it contrast? Oh, I think that helps the effect here. What do you make the contrast? He asked quietly. Isn't it, said Fleda with another glance, the contrast of something pure and free and upward tending with what is below it? To how many people do you suppose it ever occurred that smoke had a character? Said he, smiling. You are laughing at me, Mr. Carlton. Perhaps I deserve it. You do not think that, said he, with a look that forbade her to think it. But I see you are of Lavater's mind, that everything has a physiognomy. I think he was perfectly right, said Fleda. Don't you, Mr. Carlton? To some people, yes, but the expression is so subtle that only very nice sensibilities, with fine training, can hope to catch it. So they're very self-regarding. Thus basking even in such tepid rays, ever ascending, they reach and revel in the ether of religious observation until Carlton can explain how very much religion heightens the enjoyment of life. To which Fleda's heart throbbed an answer. And that's in a quote. Elitists of spiritual sensibility, they find all the world food for their calmly voracious intelligences. The life of the mind, of which Fleda and Carlton clearly consider themselves devotees, is not in evidence in the pages of Queechy. Henry Ware Jr. died in 1843, almost a decade before the publication of Queechy. He was spared seeing the fruits of his tract. Yet just before his death, he was at work on a sequel to On the Formation of the Christian Character, entitled Progress of the Christian Life. Remember Cotton Mather's Pilgrim's Progress. It might allude to. What there was of it appeared posthumously in 1847. As the title suggests, Ware's later tract was intended, like Bushnell's second work on the Atonement, to correct the excesses of his first statement. He stresses repeatedly that, quote, the life of contemplation is only valid if it produces the life of action. He particularly compares religious affections to sentimental reading. Both misused can, quote, consume and waste the sympathies by awakening the impulse to action without gratifying it. Ware's solutions to the threatened bifurcation between sensibility and realization, however, only reveal the diminution of the intellectual resources at his command. He finds the most persuasive argument for the necessity of action, finally, to be that, quote, action is an essential and all-important means of religious growth. Action, in other words, is chiefly important because it can save religious sensibility from its own excesses. It is subordinate to the, quote, formation of the Christian character. Despite Ware's acknowledgement of a certain vagueness, in quotes, which clouds the idea of Christian progress, he cannot clear it away. He offers almost no specific examples of pious action and prefers to stress only that it must be a matter of habit. Ware, determined to construct the framework of a full Christian life without recourse to theology, the second tract, like the first, absolutely, almost obsessively avoids doctrine, is like a carpenter working without his tools. Precision utterly eludes him, and this old feminist who was serious, like Camille Paglia, does not respect that. Precision utterly eludes him. And she said, if you're going to go without an institution, then passionate precision is absolutely necessary. Weir did not live to finish Progress of the Christian Life. Susan Warner went on to produce numerous sequels to Queechy. And that ends that subsection and also that chapter, chapter 4. So we see that some of these intense people were much less interested in doctrine than they would have been maybe 100 years earlier, and much more interested in directly attending to some of the ills of society and solving them. And this became Christianity to them more than studying theology or scholarship or even delivering homilies, sermons, but attending to the flocks and trying to elevate them and going out in the world and directly helping the poor or helping those in some other unfortunate situation like the insane became the new liberal way of being a Christian clergyman or a woman who is a Christian. Anyway, we've made it up through 196, so we're basically halfway through the book. It's got a lot of end notes, maybe 50, 70 pages at the end, but the text runs up to just about $3.99, I think it is. Yeah, so we've made it halfway, and we will do the rest in short order. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you, and we'll do some more real soon.